Hello. This evening, we address the third part of the teaching I've been bringing in from the Lankavatara Sutra. So, for you who weren't here, this is what you've heard me say before, yeah? That a kind of core of what I drew anyway from the Lankavatara Sutra was the teaching that, first of all, we are blessed, we are anointed on our foreheads by ancestors of all kinds, past, present, and future. And that is intimately real, and it feels like love. That with that behind us, and with the power of our vows under us, we can release, abandon, whatever word you want to use, let go of the habit mind of beginningless delusion. And that when we do that, we then are free to stand barefoot on the bare ground and meet what rises to meet us. So we've been talking about the first two parts of that. So tonight we'll come to the third part of it, the part that says we can release the habit mind of beginningless projection. Actually, I think I said delusion.
That's the word I remember from the
guitar. There was lots of projection. Yes.
Which was really great.
And you remember Red Pine saying that the Chinese was goo? That this was when Joan used to talk about the goo. And it's in the I Ching all over the place. That's that projection. Okay. So I'll say a little bit of background, and and then I'd like to come at it from two directions. So one brings with it a koan, and the other a poem or two. I'm not going to dwell a long time on the habit mind of beginningless projection. It's written about in pretty much all the sutras. So for example, in the Vimalakirti Sutra, many of you are familiar with the very much close to the opening scene where Shariputra says to the Buddha, you know, you've been talking about this pure land. So we're connected here with last night's koan, which was about the woman at the Pilgrim's Inn. But you know what? Look what's going on, man. You know, what are you thinking? This pure land is here and now, huh? And the Buddha digs his toe into the dirt. That's all he does. And suddenly, Shariputra and the 32,000 others present all see this as the Pure Land in great and beautiful detail, more gorgeous than you could dream up. And the Buddha says, I didn't change a thing. It's just you saw it. Yeah. example number one of giving up for a moment the habit mind of beginningless projection. Shariputra had a world already in mind, right? We're familiar with that world. And just digging into the actual earth, Buddha was able to show, well, who knows exactly what happened, right? That's part of the beauty of it. What we get is the sequence, not the what happened, which I love. You know, he dug his toe into the ground and Shariputra and everybody saw. And so second example. Just a second. Oh, so there's actually this isn't so hard in there, right? There's an echo again. Shariputra says, "Hey, what happened? That was easy." It's not supposed to be easy like that. Yeah. And so yeah. So what if that's also, you know, the Buddha of infinite light? Yeah. That's inside your own heart. Where else? So we have a habit of changing things, you know, one channel, which is, guess what? Fox News. Don't you love that echo with Biden's Fox? Yeah, we're all tuned into Fox News. And really? And so here's a poem that speaks a bit more crudely to the power of the addiction, okay? Short. Here it goes. I wish my voice would clear up. I think I have to give up milk, which I haven't managed to do yet. So sorry about the gravel. Okay, here's his poem. In the next installment, I'll give you Crazy Horse and Anne Frank. Their conversation, as recorded by Matthew of Gospel fame. Who was wont, as all scriveners, to add a bit of this and that? God is terse. The earth's proper scripture could be carried on a 3x5 card if we weren't drunk on our own blood. So what saves us? Yeah. What saves us? We know the has and the has not. We know both of them. We know how it is when the Buddha of infinite light is shining out from the very core of us. We know what that is. And we know the has not. We know the moments when that's not our experience at all. We know both of those states, and we come sort of on our knees going, help. Yeah? I don't know about you. And according to our scriptures, we don't usually call them that, but it's kind of that, all you need is those very same projections, friends. All you need is those very same projections of yours and a vow. The vow to transform with everyone. To transform that good stuff into freedom for all of us. And a way to see through it. We ask for that, don't we? Which happens to be what you're made of. It really is. The way to see through it is already our nature. We see through it all the time, don't we? And we replace one picture with the, you know, Fox News this morning with Fox News tomorrow morning. But in the meantime, there's always a gap. There's a moment when we're given up yesterday's news. Right? There's a moment of freedom in there all the time. And in fact, the moments of freedom may be bigger than the news reports. We don't, you know? There's to say that they are tiny and the news reports are large is actually an assumption. It may be that the news reports are just louder and that the pauses are constant and not so noticeable. So we even have assumptions about our own lights, don't we? Hard to see them. So, is this something you will finally attain? I think we know we can let that go. Yeah, it's hard to let it go, but we can let that go. Is it perhaps a feature of life pretty readily available? Could that be, actually? This very life, this one, you know? Maybe it's available to us in this very life. Is that true? Well, we could consider the possibility. We don't have too much to lose in considering the possibility. Yeah? Except the habits that have kept us comfortably miserable for quite a while. So, you know, all of the koans are designed to unleash this power in us. That's their thing. That's what they do. So, let's mess with this one koan a little bit. And I would like to present it as a picture of the practice of things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise, in Joan's translation, or in our translation of Alanka, it was more like things are not as they seem, nor are there no things. So don't get stuck on are they real or not. Yeah, they're not as they seem, but here they are, right? You know, glass, water. Fortunately. Okay, you ready for the koan? Some of you know this one and some of you don't. We haven't dealt with it in a while, at least I haven't. So this koan comes from Opening a Mountain, which is a wonderful collection. And it's called Yuan Kui Subdues the Mountain God. Master Yuan Kui of Mount Song used divination to choose a cottage in a valley deep in the mountains as a site to practice a life of reclusion. One day, a strange man appeared in the deep mountains, wearing formal attire and accompanied by a large retinue of attendants. He demanded to see the master. Yuan Kui, noticing that his visitor had a strange and unusual manner, greeted him, "Welcome, friend. Why have you come here?" The man answered, "Master, don't you recognize me?" The master replied, "I view Buddha and sentient beings equally. Why should I distinguish you from the rest of them?" The man declared, "I'm the god of the mountain and can make people live or die. How can you regard me as just one more being?" The master said, "I'm originally unborn. You claim to be able to make me die, but I see you beyond any discrimination as empty of selfhood. Even if you can destroy emptiness and yourself, I will remain unborn and undying. So why should I accept your claim to control my living and dying? The god bowed down to the floor in reverence and said, I am the most confident and upright of the gods, but I didn't realize that you possessed such eloquence and wisdom. Please grant the true precepts that will enable me to transcend the world. The master replied, when you ask about the precepts, you are already observing the precepts. Because there are no precepts apart from seeking the precepts. That's our story. It's a little bit long, but do you feel like you need to hear it one more time, or should we just sort of start walking through it? Do it that way? Just walk through it?
I don't, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yes, just walk through it.
Go on.
Okay. I think that's what y'all are okay with.
Everyone agrees with
everyone
me,
agrees.
Obviously.
All right. Thanks, guys. You're so helpful. Okay, so we have Master Yuan Kui of Mount Song, who used divination to choose a cottage in a valley deep in the mountains as a site to practice a life of reclusion. So, if this is us, yeah, it's interesting, you know, he used divination. He's not just relying on his own ordinary judgment to choose a spot, mm-hmm. Is he? He's actually, and you know, he came from a school that was totally not into any woo-woo stuff. kind of scornful of it, but here he is. He used divination, and so I love that too. You know, we mostly think we just need to do something that practically makes sense. Yeah? But in this case, you just did something that practically does not make much sense. You came here to sit in a room with a bunch of other people for hours. So we're not going to point any fingers at him. So and can you see the link, kind of, you know, you're relying on, I don't know if this is really going to help or not, but here it is, I'm going, it seems I'm going, kind of feeling, right? And so he chose a cottage in a valley deep in the mountains, and this means in the terms of Chinese lore and in fact, you know, in the wild places where you don't know who else lives there, and you're a little bit more on alert, at least I sure am if I'm backpacking in the mountains, a little more alert than I am other times. So it's not ordinary, and yet he's just there, he's got a cottage, he's going to have a simple life. Yeah? One day, a strange man appeared in the deep mountains wearing formal attire and accompanied by a large retinue of attendants. So already you know something kind of magical is going on, because there aren't people in there, for one thing. Where do you get his large retinue of attendants? And why is this guy all dressed up in formal dress? And how did he even find you in your little cottage in the wilds, in the deep mountains? So it's interesting in this case, you know, it's like something appears, right? And so if we're sort of in the territory of projections, right? Something appears that may not be exactly what it seems to be, right? We have a hint that there's something slightly shady about this appearance. So, and don't we often have that feeling? I thought that feeling's kind of familiar. Something shows up, it's very commanding in its appearance, but something about it doesn't quite ring true. You know, my belief about this, that, or the other thing. You know, my image of somebody, my image of myself. Yeah. So he appears. So already things are not as they seem. We've got the first part of it. Yeah? Something's fishy here. So he demanded to see the master. Well, do we have things appear that demand our attention or not? Yuan Kuei, noticing that his visitor had a strange and unusual manner, greeted him. Welcome, friend. Why have you come here? How about that as a practice? Yeah. When our opinions and our views of things demand to be seen by us. Yeah. Welcome, friend. Why are you here? Why have you come? So the man answered, Master, don't you recognize me? Does that sound familiar? Yeah, you know me, your belief about how you'll never succeed, how life will never suit you, or whatever it is. Master, don't you recognize me? The master replied, I view Buddha and sentient beings equally. Why should I distinguish you from the rest of them? That equally, you know, has a power in our teachings, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the meeting everybody on level ground, right? Meeting everything that arises on level ground. So we get the feeling that Yuan Kuei pretty much has his feet under him, doesn't he? He's steady. He's steady. He knows. I meet. It's like that standing on the bare ground stance we were talking about, isn't it? I'm meeting you just as you are. Why should I distinguish you from the rest of them? And we can take that as a genuine question. And especially when something is so much in our face that it demands, it won't go away, right? Like those thoughts in meditation that cycle around and come back and won't go away, you know? So what if he's really asking the question, why you? Why are you commanding my attention? But there's also a kind of a, we could take it as a comment. But the man declared, I'm the god of the mountain and can make people live or die. That's why. How can you regard me as just one more being? So here we have those appearances and those beliefs that have the power of, claim to have the power of life or death. Right? this is a life or death matter. You pay attention to me now, right? And our heart gets pumping and our, you know, adrenaline is flowing. And this one, I actually really have to pay attention to this one, right? I'm special and powerful. I have power over your life and death. And these things get laid down early, don't they? When we're learning how to survive. But the master says, I'm originally unborn. It's a pretty simple statement, isn't it? He's not really arguing. He's just saying, I know this about myself.
Say that again.
He's just saying, I know this about myself. I am originally unborn. I've looked for where I come from, and I don't find a beginning point. I arise with everything all the time. Yeah. There's no bornness to that. I am originally unborn. You claim to be able to make me die, but I see you. Isn't that beautiful? Just I see you. Beyond any discrimination, as empty of selfhood. I am originally unborn, I know it, and this is how I see you. Right through the delusion, right? I see you also as empty of selfhood. So that's a way of greeting the projection, isn't it? I know that I am not born, not destroyed. I know that you are not stained, not pure, right? No eye, no ear, no nose. You have no separate fixed being. I see you. And I don't accept your claim. He says, even, and listen to this next part, even if you can destroy emptiness and yourself. Isn't that interesting? He puts it right to, you could destroy, even if you could destroy emptiness and yourself, I will remain unborn and undying. That's confidence, isn't it? I know this. I know this. Not born. Not destroyed. No old age and death, and also no ending of old age and death. So why should I accept your claim to control my living and dying? You just popped that balloon, didn't you? And so, I don't accept your claim. I see you. And I don't accept your claim. There's no hostility in that, is there? There's no aggression in it. Mm-hmm. It's just, I see, I know me, I see me, and I see you. And this is what I see. There's something so intimate about that, yeah? And can we address our own projections with that much equanimity? Right? I'll meet you on the bare ground. I know me, and I'll see you. And isn't this maybe what our projections ask of us? Mm-hmm. To be seen? In a way, that's, you know, there's a resonance with Rilke even, isn't there? And these things need us. Us, the most fleeting of all. And things, you know, in the Sanskrit dharma applies to all the many dharmas, right, is the term for things as they appear, right? Not claiming reality or unreality. So that includes your projections, yeah? Not real, You know, not as they seem and not otherwise. What's a digression? So at this point, when he asks that question, why should I accept your claim to control my living and dying? He's really asking, isn't he? He's engaging the appearance, the delusion. Why should I? Give me a good reason why I should believe you. And the god bowed down to the floor in reverence. Just boom, right down. And said, I am the most confident and upright of the gods. Which doesn't seem to me as any more the kind of bluster that we were getting. It's like, gosh, this is who I am. This is what I represent. Think about that with respect to your delusions, to your projections. What if they are not bad, right? What if they are, in fact, your teachers, you know, are sacred in some way? I am the most confident and upright of the gods, but I didn't realize that you possess such eloquence and wisdom. That's a confession. That's purification, right? I missed it. I didn't recognize who you were. I didn't see you, the projection says. And asks for forgiveness. Asks to receive the precepts. To me, it's really, really touching when I think of it that way, as what my projections might be asking of me. You know, I just didn't quite see it. You know, what I hear him saying. And please grant me the true precepts that will enable me to transcend the world. And this one's kind of catches me. I don't know if it catches any of you, because that transcend the world part, got a little uh-oh. We still got some work to do here. But in any case, that's what he says. And then the master replies, when you ask about the precepts, you are already observing the precepts, because there are no precepts apart from seeking out the precepts. So I'm sure this is a great relief for you precept takers to hear. All this work he's been doing, forget it. Too late.
Rewrite.
So to me, this seems like such a beautiful description of practice, this whole koan. Number one, you don't go looking for it. It comes to get you. Yeah, it finds you. And that reminded me of Zhao Zhou's I Don't Abide in Clarity. He didn't stay in a clear place. He went into the very confusing place in the depths of the mountains where the you know, snakes and lions and demons and all kinds of who knows what lives, right? And where you don't know what something is and something might appear or not. Anyway, you get the drift of that. But it is like practice, right? Practice finds you when you go into your unknown, when you leave your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. Yeah? When you go to the place where you don't understand. And number two, you welcome it. You welcome it. It's asking for you by name. It's calling your name. Yeah? And all you've done is make yourself fetchable. Number three, you look deeply to see through its disguise, and it turns out to be fundamentally okay. Upright, God, sacred. And it repents of its mistaken view. And number four, you let it in. You grant its wish by affirming its true nature along with your own. Things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. Not trying to pin it down, but just offering the precepts. Yeah? So I have a couple of footnotes here. Heine, who's the compiler of this book, Stephen, points out that, you know, in traditional Buddhist practice of the time, people took 250 ethical vows. I doubt if they were required to write their own statement of each one. And that was the guys. The women had like three times as many, right? It's true. Sad, but true. And you know, every 2 weeks, a repentance ceremony that functioned as a kind of Sabbath. You know, it was like that was what church was. Every 2 weeks, you went and you confess how you'd broken the precepts and you didn't do better kind of stuff. And Zen rejected the idea of, you know, practicing these precepts as like specific codes of conduct, like, you know, commandments. And that sort of examining each other and, you know, making rules out of them, rules of the order. But instead, this, as this koan shows, said, look, what's important is to examine your true nature, is to get to stay in that field of equanimity, of meeting everything equally, because you have, you're rooted, your understanding is rooted in the fundamental nature of how things are. You know, the unborn, not born, not destroyed, all interwoven and not interwoven, all of that. And so the way we work with our precepts is to try to do that, right? Is to try to come from our fundamental experience of how it really is and let the ancestors speak to that to help us with the particulars. He also pointed out that Huainan's Platform Sutra distinguished between repentance about things and repentance about the principle of emptiness. So it's interesting, in this koan, you see the God repenting of his mistaken view, because that was what mattered. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says, I didn't see it. And so this is, in our practice, that kind of reminder that what we do is continually, as Joan says, hold our beliefs provisionally, ready, hold them lightly, ready to abandon when they don't hold up. And to, as much as we can, not just replace them with the next idea. to get more and more comfortable with the open space in which we haven't replaced that one with the next one. And there was a P.S., there's a later part of the story, what do you call that?
A coda,
there we go. So the coda is, I loved this, I had never read it before. The deity, it turns out, repays his indebtedness by magically transplanting cedar trees on the mountain. He goes and plants trees.
In his socks.
No doubt. And then Yuan Kuei tells his disciples not to talk about it. Don't tell anybody, because it might seem like we're supporting the supernatural. that great? Okay, so now I have one more poem for you. Because I think this poem, besides the fact that I just am in love with this guy, too bad he's dead, is...
is this who you've been reading from?
Yeah, yeah, Tony Hoagland. The other, I've got two different authors I'm reading from, but this poem is from Tony Hoagland. And see if you feel the links here. It's called Happy and Free. You probably know all of these by heart. Yeah. Happy and Free. I should not have gotten the tattoo that says, "May all beings be happy and free," on my left arm. Running from the inside of my elbow to the wrist in 20-point Verdana sans serif type. My serotonin level that day was so elevated that it deceived me into an optimistic feeling that I was finally ready to be pure. I have been happy in that way before, and you would think I would have learned by now that I inevitably return to Earth like a leaky, gradually deflating helium balloon. Now I see that my great tattoo might better have been a customized sweatshirt purchased online for $20 that said, sorry, that said, short attention span. Or university of repetitive emotion. How quickly things pass, how long mistakes last. How unrealistic I am when left to my own devices. When I rolled up my shirt sleeve at the tattoo emporium to have that sentence stenciled into my pale flesh, I was getting into a relationship I could not possibly sustain. May all things be happy, all beings be happy and free. What a fitting punishment for the hubris of my passing and unstable self-esteem. And yet, it is my life, mine to squander as I will. That is a kind of freedom, I suppose. And I have a story which is still unfinished. That makes me kind of happy, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.